Welcome to Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with the chronic illness of sickle cell disease. Today we'll be speaking with Dr. Steve Froelich, counselor, shaman, extraordinaire. Hi, Steve. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Adrienne. Good to be with you this afternoon.
Well, when I called you up and said, let's talk again, it was with, I guess, this feeling that I'm dealing with now, and a lot of people are dealing with grief and loss, and I thought you'd be the perfect person to help us at this point in time. So can you give us, from a clinical standpoint, at least to start this out, what is grief or the process of grieving?
Okay. Wow. This is, it's a very heavy subject for us, and it's something that we all have to deal with because it really does center around loss. When thinking about loss, we can suffer losses in many realms and in many ways. It could be the loss of a loved one. It could be the loss of one's health. It could be the loss of various abilities that can happen as we get older. It could be a loss of a job. I think you can see that, we need to broaden our thinking when we think about a subject such as grief, because for all of those losses comes grieving, which is a natural process, a painful process for us, but a natural process.
I remember when Marissa was diagnosed, and at first my reaction, of course, was no, she couldn't, I've been responsible, I had the test, and the test said I didn't have the trait, and anyway, we kind of worked through that, and when it finally became clear that I'd gotten a false negative, and it became clear that Marissa had sickle cell disease, the first feelings I remember having was a fear for her life, fear that she was going to have a short life, and it would be with this great amount of pain. And I remember kind of going through that and learning the things I could do to keep basically the pain at bay. And she was young and, pretty healthy, and we didn't understand that with sickle cell, there's some of us who start off really healthy, and then there's those of us that start off very sick and with the pain as babies. But as time went on, it was like I had another kind of feelings that kind of set in. I was going to be the mother of the child who couldn't go swimming. I was going to be the mother of the child that wasn't going to do athletics. It was like a grief of what it was that I didn't have. I didn't have it, and then I couldn't have it, which was really a surprise for me.
Well, I think, and please tell me if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly or the way that you intend, but talking with you right now as a fellow parent for a minute, not just a mental health professional, but as a parent, we have our fantasies for our children. We have our wishes, dreams, and hopes for them. We have the picture of ourself, as their parents doing, as we see them doing the various things that we hope and wish that they're able to do. And it sounds like you were forced by a diagnosis to re-examine those pictures of what your life was going to look like, what your daughter's life was going to look like, and what your life as a family was going to look like.
Yeah. And, I hadn't thought about that in a long time. I mean, we worry so much about our kids dying and what grief comes with that. But there seems to be loss in many ways along the journey. And like you said, with everybody, right? We kind of think, see everything through the filter of having sickle cell or whatever our chronic disease that we're living with. Almost sometimes with the fantasy that the healthy people have none of these issues, right? That, of course, they're healthy and therefore aren't dealing with the things that we are dealing with or have to deal with in life.
Yeah.
I think it is the realization. Maybe parenting really does help you kind of maybe figure this out. Because, of course, kids come here how they are. No matter what you do, they're going to some degree, be who they are.
And yes, they are.
And then there's that loss of the them that you thought they would be. Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, so let's talk about the context of something that happens in our community a lot. And that is the parents have struggled and done all they can, and they get their children through childhood and adolescence, which is really, really hard. And in our case, our children have like a prolonged adolescence, not a delayed adolescence, but prolonged, where they're dependent on us in ways that many young adults aren't, right? Because they're dependent on us to get them to the hospital. We have this relationship with them about reminding them to take their medicine. We have this vigil that many of us hold over them in order, trying to keep them healthy. And we get them to be, young adults. And I think one of the first losses is the loss of their pediatrician. The pediatrician becomes all, for us parents, they're the trusted voice. They're the ones that tell us if we do certain things, our child's going to be okay. They're the ones who, run all the tests and then come back and give us results in language that we can understand. So they really become more than just our doctors. They become our teachers, our friends, our fellow advocate for our child. And then when our child gets 21 and 11 months and 30 days, all of a sudden that's severed.
Yeah.
And we have to then go off to adult docs. And we aren't prepared for that. It really feels like not a divorce, because a divorce is kind of where you say, okay, we're at a point now where we're going to part. It's not a voluntary kind of thing. And it's not quite abandonment. I'm not sure where it fits, but you've been torn away from this person who's been so important. And then you meet the adult doc while you're in this period of kind of shock and grief. And nobody really helps prepare us for that, right?
Adrian, I had never thought about that experience and that transition that you just expressed. But as you were sharing, what I was thinking is how hard that has to be, because for all those years, you have this trusted person, and you feel, as the parent, you feel with that doctor, because that's where your relationship is, and your feelings of trust that you built up over time. You've been through, any number of health crises already, and that person has been the one with you while you've gone through those scary times. What a huge loss that would be. And it never even crossed my mind, not having gone through that. And yet that makes so much sense, because it's natural for us to feel safe in that everything's going to be okay when we're with that trusted person, you know, who has sort of shepherded us through some very difficult times already. And now all of a sudden I have to face, you know, life without that person and start all over with somebody new. I can only imagine, you know, how much anxiety would be attached to that transition.
Yeah, I hadn't thought. I'm so into trying to get everything taken care of and looking out for risks, not really even seeing how much anxiety I was going through.
Of course.
And that's a real loss. I'm going to have to add this to our list of loss that we have on this journey. We have loss. We have loss in ways that of things being the way we imagine they would be, right? And then we have a loss such as of losing our pediatrician as we go. And generally also in the disease community, very few relationships survive the diagnosis of a chronically ill child. I forget the statistics, but they're very, very high. And so you've got the grief of not having a normal child, then in many cases the grief of a relationship failing. And then you go through this other next step of losing your trusted pediatrician.
Yeah.
Wow.
You're just getting hammered, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I really see that now. And then you go into this phase where we have the adult phase, where the trauma comes of trying to go and get care as an adult. In that desire to create that safe space where you were when you had a pediatrician, you know, where you knew what was going to happen and you knew the people who you were going to for help wanted to help you and were going to help you. And then suddenly now you're faced with, the emergency room or the emergency department where it seems by their actions and procedures that they want to help you, but they want to help you in their own way.
Yeah, and once you get to the ER, it's a very institutional, sterile, procedurally driven environment. You know, I understand that the nurses and the doctors are people, but they're in a different mindset as a rule because they're triaging and there's usually a lot of people sitting there that need care, and they have a process to keep some kind of order, you know, in that room, and still be able to take care of the needs of patients. And when you're the patient, you know, or when you're the parent of the patient, you just want your child and his or her, you know, condition addressed, and you want to make sure that your kid's okay. It's a different state of mind. And when we're talking about a parent-child dynamic, you know, that's a pretty intense dynamic. It's, you know, if I take myself to the ER because I hurt myself as an adult, that's one thing, you know, but if I take my kid to the ER, it's a whole different story.
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit about that story. And maybe you can give us some insight into how can we, knowing that that's what we're feeling, what can we do in order to mitigate our being overwhelmed by it? So we're going to take a break now. This is Access Advocacy, and we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Froelich. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment on thepowerofvoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Adrienne Shapiro on Access Advocacy via thepowerofvoices.com. And today we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Froelich about grief and the grieving process. Welcome back, Dr. Steve.
Thanks, Adrienne. It's good to be here with you. And this is a subject that we all deal with. It's not an easy one.
The thing that I keep thinking about in our last bit of conversation is I know that I'm driven as a parent to to protect and do the best for and by my child. There are many, many mothers, we call them the polar bear mothers, who are the same way. I mean, we almost like can feel our, each other's energy and identify with each other. But I didn't realize to such a large degree that really was driven by grief or fear of having to face grief, the loss, or more loss.
Yeah. So, Adrian, if I may, I think that there are some unique challenges that parents of kids growing up with chronic illnesses like sickle cell would be facing that other parents with healthier kids, they just wouldn't face. I think most parents would identify as being protective and even overprotective, but when you have a child with a chronic illness, there are reasons to be overprotective. And so, we all want our kids to grow up and be independent and functioning, without our assistance. That's a parent's goal for their kids. But when you have a child that's growing up with health issues that really require special attention, then you're stuck as a parent. And I don't mean that stuck in a bad way. I just mean the reality is different. And you do need to be more mindful, and you do need to meet needs for your child that you wouldn't otherwise have to meet. And so it sets up other issues. So you have kids growing up, and they're having parents that are, paying extra attention to a lot of health-related details, and, making sure that they're eating right, sleeping right, that they're not overextending, that they're not overdoing and hovering inappropriately so, because if the parent wasn't doing that, there could be severe consequences. And now you've got this child, or maybe they're approaching their adolescence, and it's natural in adolescence for the kids to push back when they're feeling confined, and now you end up in a battle. And as a parent, you're caught because you want your kid to have different experiences as they're growing up. By the same token, you're seeing as a parent, because your adult mind is able to see them, all the potential threats, you're supporting your child in other ways that could be seen as being overly protective or codependent in a different situation. But in the situation you're in, it's perfectly appropriate and, in fact, many times necessary. So, boy, what a setup for conflict and frustration on everybody's part.
Yeah, that frustration.
Right?
Yes. The frustration of thinking you're in a good place and you're going to be able to have a good night's sleep, and then there's that sound and that the child's in pain, and that means you're going to have to get up and drive across town and go to the ER, and you're going to have to suit up, put your warrior bracelets on like Wonder Woman, because you're going to have to navigate through the triage process in the ER to get your child what they need.
And you're doing that with a group of strangers who you don't know, and now you're entrusting your vulnerable, sick child to these people that you don't have any relationship or rapport with. How do you do that?
I know, and they're looking at you because, you and I are saying our child, because we understand child, and they're looking at us like, well, this is an adult, but this is still my child. It's a weird kind of like, oh. And
right.
You're absolutely right about them being strangers. They're strangers, and I agree that they have their processes and things, but it's scary because their processes, many times, I'd say 90% of the time, do not include reading the patient's chart. In Marissa's case, we go to the same hospital. She's been going to that hospital over 20 years, well over 20 years. And every time, well, I won't say every time, but I'd say 98% of the time, I have to ask the ER docs to please read her chart. So it's almost like, what is that, Groundhog Day?
Yeah, it is, because you're going through the same process over and over again. And, you know, not every parent would be as educated as you. I mean, you are smart and you're a very educated person, and you're someone that wants to understand. And so you've gone the extra mile to understand. You know, many of us, you know, myself included, if I walk into an ER with a loved one, you know, I'm just another patient or another parent, and I feel totally vulnerable and at the mercy of whoever's taking care of my either me or my family member, and that's very anxiety provoking. You know, that puts most of us, I think, you know, way out of our comfort zone, and we can react sometimes poorly to that, which might be counterproductive to us getting the things that we need to get taken care of. So it's very challenging, and while it's perfectly natural to be very anxious, frightened, feel out of control in that hospital environment, for those that are not as used to being in it, to react too much to it makes taking care of the issues more difficult, because if you treat the nurses badly, they probably aren't going to be as helpful as they could be.
Yeah, absolutely. It is this thing that I've been dealing with lately. So I had someone that I had been advocating for many years, a young mother, and was a close friend of Marissa's. And we'd been going through this last year, ER visits and hospitalizations, and many, many times of going through, as you said, like what I call, you know, Groundhog Day, where we would go and we'd talk to the docs and we'd go through kind of a dance, for lack of a better way to put it. And she then would get admitted, and then she'd be on the floor, and then depending upon what time, what staff showed up for that particular shift, it was, dare I leave her on her own? Or, no, they're really great. They understand what's going on. You can go home and go to sleep, that kind of thing. And this had gone on for several months, and she was having complications. She would then really want to get out of the hospital. So she would, I mean, you know, those of us who are in the hospital all the time get to know hospital, you know, hospital speak. I would say, I think you really need to stay longer. And she would say, oh, I have all these things to do, and check herself out. This went on quite a few times. And during one of these times, she got herself checked out, and I went to visit her. She was with her real mother, because I'm known as Mom too, right?
Yeah.
I could tell she was really in bad shape, and this was not normal. Sickle cell is different. It's very, very unique to each person, because, you know, they've had a personal relationship with sickle cell, and it's damaged what it's damaged in their body and may not be damaging in somebody else's body. It's basically their body assaulting itself. So there's no typical. And I said, I really want you to go back to the hospital. Please, please go back to the hospital. And I begged. And I said, you know, I really want you alive. You have a daughter, you have this, you have that. And she and her mother said no. That she'd have a nap, and once she got a nap, then it would be okay. And I said, okay, well, then I have to leave. It was very difficult for me to see her in that condition. and go against all of my instincts, which were yelling and screaming. And actually, I said to her, I really want to go. I'm doing everything I can because I want to keep you alive. And then she looked at me with those beautiful eyes and like in shock, like, and said, "What do you mean alive?" And I said, "Alive, like here on this earth, like living, like not dead."
Right.
And she says to me, "Oh, well, I've taken my meds and I'm just going to sleep." So I said to the mom, "Okay, I'm just going to go a short distance away. You can call me. I'll be back. I can be back here in less than 10 minutes." Because I had to walk away. I could not stay. All of me was screaming. Kind of like a horror movie, you know, where you're warning people, don't go down that alley.
Yeah.
At any rate, I left, and within not even an hour, the mom calls and is yelling through the phone, 911. I get back. There's the paramedics. There's a fire truck. There are two different sets of police cars. There's all the emergency responders that you're so familiar with.
Oh, wow.
And I couldn't park my car. They were all in the middle of the street, right, or this cul-de-sac. And I remember I just stopped my car and I just went running to the house. And they were working on her and they took her to the hospital and she'd had a cardiac arrest and they brought her back and they were doing all these things, you know, that they do to help her. So they put her in a coma to give her body some time to readjust for the gas levels and everything to come back up. And at any rate, she passed away. And I was truthfully, sad. And I think now, talking in the grieving.
When did this happen, Adrienne?
This was in July.
Just this last July.
Mm-hmm. And I feel so responsible. I feel like, why didn't I call 911? Why didn't I fight harder? Why couldn't I, with all my gifts of persuasion, why couldn't I convince them to go to the hospital? Why didn't I just call 911 and have them like show up at the door? I mean, I don't know what would have happened. I feel so sad and broken, and I miss her, and I feel like, why? I mean, you know, I feel like I'm really mad at the docs, because the docs should never had released her. I mean, if I as a layman can look at her and say she's deathly ill, how could a team of doctors and nurses whose job it is to keep people alive release her from the hospital? In what educated and sane world does stuff like that happen? And yet I know she's the fifth one in our sickle cell community to have complications and die within a day or two of being released.
So, Adrienne, this conversation that we're having right now, when you asked me to talk about grief, and I started to talk about grief, it was a concept. It was something you could read about or hear a lecture on. But in the last few minutes, as you've talked about your relationship with this child and your role in her life and your attachment to her, your feelings about her and her having symptoms and having a health emergency and all that. Now it went from being a concept, it went from being an idea that somebody was talking about to an experience that you had, that she had, that you shared with her, and you're faced with your powerlessness, and you're faced with the limitations of your human condition. And now, in the face of her death, in the face of the trauma that you've experienced through her death and the loss that you're experiencing and undergoing right now, you're doing what we do, you know, when we face these things. And you're trying to make sense out of it, and it's really, really hard to, and it's really painful, and it's really, really sad, and you're going through the trauma, and in the trauma of this, you're going through the woulda, coulda, shouldas, and your mind is looking at the scenario from every angle, trying to make some sense out of something that makes no sense, you know. And on top of that trauma, you're dealing with the loss of someone that you care deeply for, and you're going through that process. So I'm just so sorry that you're having to go through this right now, but it's I don't know any other way.
We're going to take a break.
Okay.
Welcome back. I'm Adrienne Shapiro on Access Advocacy. We're speaking with Dr. Stephen Froelich, and our talk has taken a little bit of a turn in the way I thought it would go. Today's topic is grief, and we're actually touched upon my own personal grief. So I think we're just going to go with this, if that's okay with you, Dr. Steve.
When you asked me to do this, I had no idea where the conversation would go, but I just trust that that things happen for a reason.
So I miss her. I miss her daughter that I don't get to see anymore. I miss her mother, who I interacted with, but now her mother's grieving in her own way.
Yeah.
I'm feeling guilty because I'm so sad, and I feel like I don't have the right to be this sad because I still have Marissa. I'm angry. I'm angry at the docs. I'm angry at the healthcare system. I'm angry. And I'm guilty. I feel guilty that I'm angry because I know that to have had her, you know, for 30 plus years is amazing. And if we were in any other country, she would, as well as Marissa and so many hundreds of others, be dead before they were 2 years old. I feel helpless, like in that moment of if I had like any power, I could have lifted her up and taken her to the hospital. Or if I had any real voice or power, there would be rules in place so hospitals couldn't just sign our patients out who were clearly not well enough to function outside of the hospital. I feel the sadness and the anger and just the injustice of it all, that this kid now is going to not have a parent. She's not going to have a mother. And I raised a child without a parent. And it's like kind of, it's like this permanent abandonment, right? So I know that this poor little child is going to have that in her life. I almost feel like there's just so much of, it's just so much. There's just so much that's gone as a result of her life. So much back to that, so much loss. So I guess I've gone through, I know there's steps. I know there's steps. I'm probably, knowing me, I've skipped a few.
You know, on the idea of there being stages of grief, and I know, you know, most of us have heard of Helen Kubler-Ross and the stages of grief. It's interesting because her work was done with dying people, people that had terminal illnesses, and she was trying to understand how did individuals who knew they were dying, how did they deal with that knowledge, and how did they come to terms, or did they come to terms with their own death? And that's where the stages of grief really came from. But it wasn't really meant for those of us who are mourning the loss of a loved one or dealing with the death of someone we know. It's been sort of transferred over, generalized over into this area, but it wasn't really designed or developed out of that work. So the stages, you know, anger or denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, those stages that Helen Kubler-Ross wrote about were really for an individual coming to terms with their own death. So those stages, when applied to grieving, you know, they're just not necessarily going to be followed. You may not have that experience. You may have some of it. You may have none of it. You may have, it may come in a different order, and it may not come at all. So I would always encourage people to take those stages as, you know, very, very generally, and not hold themselves to any one of those stages.
Well, I know that in our community, particularly the loved ones, you know, the parents, the mates, the we kind of are always trying to prepare ourselves for, you know, the ultimate loss. I don't know how we or what we can do to help the siblings. I just thought about that. I mean, I spoke to you many times about my guilt about having Casey and bringing her into the world, knowing that her sister was sick and knowing that she was going to witness the challenges of her sister's life, and that it was going to affect her in ways. And again, trying to do everything I can to normalize our situation. But I also brought this other young woman into our lives. I mean, she was in our lives. She was friends into Casey's life. And she's now suffered this loss along with us. Are there some things that you can suggest that we can help our younger people who are witnessing or experiencing it, not from as close a view, but that are going through this with us at the same time?
Well, that's a really good point, because when things happen, whatever they are within families, it will impact the entire family system. And so I would suggest that the more we can keep open communication the better it's going to be for everybody involved. You know, everybody's very individual. We all have our own personalities. Those are the traits that we're born with, that genetic stuff. So I don't think it would be right to generalize, well, this is what it would be like for any individual growing up in a particular family, because there's always going to be a variation of experience. So I don't think that we can have a how-to book for this, but I do think that we can work on making it okay to talk about things.
Yeah. I have, it's interesting. That's interesting that you would come up with that. That's pretty simple. Isn't it? I was thinking, do I reach out to her, to the real mother? I was thinking, do I bring her up in conversation with Casey? You know, do I take the pictures down I have of us? I mean, and I guess these are things that everybody kind of goes through when there's been a death. It almost makes me wish, you know, they set Shiva. That in my head, I think if there was some kind of ritual where we could all sit and eat together and or just be together, not just for a meal after a service, which is customary in our culture, but somehow collectively have our grieving, a kind of bond over our grief. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense, but you know, I'd make the following suggestions on this, because sadly, I don't know, unfortunately, I have to say, I've been in a position to walk alongside of many, many people that are going through grief, going through death, going through life-changing circumstances. And I wish I could tell you that there was one thing, you know, that if we did that thing, it would make it better, it would make it okay. Because, you know, there is no making it okay when you're at the beginning of grief. It's horrific. It's traumatic. It's painful. You know, there are those circumstances where if somebody has lived a long life, you know, they're 90 years old or they're 100 years old and they've done what they've wanted to do and lived the life that they wanted to live and they die in their sleep. You know, I think that's one type of death that most of us would be okay with, you know, and then we would have that celebration of life kind of funeral, you know, where we're there to just say goodbye to someone who had a wonderful life and we're glad that we had them for as long as we did. But when it doesn't line up like that, when it's a parent mourning the loss of a child, I don't know any simple way to go through that. I don't know any good way to go through that. It's a painful, traumatic journey that is filled with the most intense emotion, the most conflicted emotion, that doesn't go away or get better. You know, people go on in a way, but their lives are not ever the same. That's my experience, and I hope I'm not sounding pessimistic, because that's not my intention, but realistic is what I'm after on this part of the discussion, because, you know, I've just watched that struggle, and it is a struggle, and I have felt honored to be able to walk alongside of individuals that are going through that experience. It's hard. It's just hard.
I think that that's probably like the most insightful thing about this discussion is that it's hard. I mean, and I realized that I've been fighting it all summer. You know, I kept getting sick, and it was one thing after another, and I was thinking, oh my God, and like, actually, I was like, I'm not cut out for this advocacy stuff. I should get somebody else to do it, somebody who's better qualified, somebody who could either get those and make those doctors and make people listen to them, you know, that maybe I'm too weak, right? Or that my heart is too big, and that I love, and maybe somebody whose heart isn't like mine would be better suited. But it, in hearing what you're saying, it's just hard. And God knows I know heart, and I know, and in a large part thanks to you, and that heart's just part of life. And we have a choice. Either we spend our energy dealing with hard and move on and are open to the next thing, or we use our energy hiding from hard and have a life that's just in hiding.
Yeah, and that's very insightful. And I would also say there's going through these things, you can go through these things as a concept, or you can go through these things as an experience. And you know, what you're talking about is the experience of grief, not the idea of it. And, in, you know, you also have to remember, and for you, and I don't mean to turn this into a counseling session, but I don't know any other way to make this comment. You can't be talking about the grief you're feeling of over the loss of somebody that you knew without also being mindful of what that means in terms of rest and you and what she struggles with and what you struggle with. And that's deeply, I mean, does it get any more personal?
No.
So this has to, when things like this resonate in your heart, and they that resonance touches more personal places, it just intensifies the experience, whether we are talking about grief or some other emotion. You just can't help that. And so this one was going to, and I apologize for the language, but this was going to kick your ass.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, because it's personal.
Yeah. And it did. It did. I spent this, now that we're talking about it, I spent this summer sick. Well, parts of it. I got mono. Who gets mono at my age? And I think it was because it was kicking my ass. And I was not honoring it.
You know, and there's just certain things that we can deny, we can defend, we can buffer, but at the end of the day, we're human. And if something is got our number attached to it, it's going to resonate with us in a very deeply personal way, whether we're aware of it or not aware of it, conscious, not conscious, we're going to be feeling it, and we're going to react to it, and that is just the human condition. And so if we can be a little more aware, then we can maybe deal with it in more healthy ways. In other words, maybe not by getting sick, maybe by crying or talking or screaming, whatever we got to do to get it out, but maybe to get it out a little bit more directly. And if it's so painful that we can't look at it yet, then we're going to defend and we're going to protect ourselves and we're going to deal with it the best way that we can. It might make us sick. It might get us to act out. It might get us to use unhealthy coping mechanisms. But that's just part of being human, and we have to forgive ourselves, and we have to be patient with ourselves and each other and hopefully get to a place where we can be a little bit more aware and then deal with those feelings that we're going to have in a little bit more healthy way. But, man, it is a challenge. It's a struggle. And life can be very, very difficult when we're talking about your child and your feelings. That's quite different than talking about children in general or what people can go through. And, you know, it's just a different conversation.
Yeah, and I think that's the perfect way to end this conversation. And I wanna thank you, Dr. Steve. I wanna thank you.
Well, thank you, Adrian. It's my honor, and this is a deeply meaningful and personal conversation for all of us. So thank you for including me.
Thank you. Well, we're out of time. But I need to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's axisadvocacy.org. Join us again next Tuesday on thepowerofvoices.com at noon Pacific, or listen anytime on demand at accessadvocacy.org. You'll find all our programs there. I'm Adrian Shapiro. Thank you for listening.